Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we are going to be talking about terrorism and the politics of fear. We're having sociologist David Altaidi come to the show, and he's going to be talking about all his research into the mass media and how they're using fear as a way to manipulate the public. He actually teaches sociology at the university level, and this is something he's been teaching for a while now, and he wrote a book called Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and that came out back in 2006, but he has a new edition that's coming out this fall. And of course, with all the things that are going on in this world and the never-ending wars in Syria and ISIS and the terrorism that is happening in mostly in overseas in the Middle East and not so much here. We get things here and there. But he's going to talk about how that is all tied to the mass media and the way that they're constructing fear in America. And he's going to argue that politicians and decision makers bear much of the blame for the promotion of fear among citizens that result in the loss of civil liberties in return for greater protection. We all are talking about this. NSA doing mass surveillance. Is that a good thing? Most people I associate with do not like it. But I've heard many people say, I don't care if they're surveilling us as long as I'm safer. I've heard that many times. I've heard that in my classroom. I've heard that from my friends. I don't like it, but I hear it. And I think it's more people who have never been subjected to government tyranny. They've never been a victim of anything like that. So they don't think it's really possible. But if you ever see it firsthand, that's when you do a 180 and you are not in favor of this stuff. So he's going to come on and talk about this. He's going to talk about how it's in entertainment. It's in popular culture and news. He also talks about how it helps generate profits. It enables political decision makers to cynically manipulate citizens and can lead to major institutional changes, even war. So this is going to be a really interesting, in-depth conversation with David Altaidi, and I want to get into that interview now.
Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hey, it's nice to be here and talk about the pressing issues of the day.
Yeah, these are important issues, and you have been studying this for many, many years. So it's great to have you on to discuss this. So let's dive right into it. What is the benefit for using fear and propaganda? What are they doing? Why are they doing it? Why is the government or anybody else doing that?
Well, propaganda of fear is used because it works. The goal is to get people's attention, to direct them toward either a certain product or a certain policy, or to get their compliance and agreement with some kind of action. And it's intended to mobilize them individually and collectively. And so it works very well.
It works, so they keep doing it. So how do people react? What is the outcome, other than it working? What is the outcome of fear-based propaganda?
Well, fear is a very distinctive kind of propaganda. I mean, all propaganda, of course, is oriented to basically using information to achieve a goal, to achieving, your particular aim, whatever it is. Fear is very effective because if done right, that is to say, if done for maximum impact, fear basically limits the audience's other options. Fear is grabbing. It seems like it's immediate, and it demands your attention and compliance. So you cut off other options. You basically reduce a good deal of cognitive activity. That is, you're thinking less. and you're feeling more, and it's targeted and aimed at surviving and security and avoiding the threat. And that can be very, very effective if you're a business, a government, an organization that has very, very clear goals in mind. You want to mobilize and direct people and get them to act on your behalf.
So what fears do you see today in the media that is, there's a lot of it, but what are you seeing that you can tell that specifically they're using fear-based propaganda on purpose?
Well, you know, the sort of the brief history of this to lead up to this, you know, your focus on today is that the category is fear dealing with the security and safety of your life, your way of life, your physical life, and that of your family. And this goes back a long way in the United States for the focus on crime, and maybe we'll return to that in a few minutes. We've had decades of sensational reports about the threat of crime, especially street crime, to our individual safety, to our family safety, and even to our economic well-being. And this has had very important effects because it's led people to focus on street crime rather than, let's say, other kinds of crime, so-called white-collar crime, crime in the suites, corruption, fraud, and things of that sort.
Well, because if you look at it, that's an excellent point, because we have mass incarceration issues. I mean, if you look at the charts, it just goes up. It's crazy right now. But yet, at the same time that we're incarcerating people at higher percentages than ever, we aren't doing anything about white. Well, we shouldn't say aren't doing anything, because we are. But there's been a lot of white collar criminals, as we all know from the 2008, you know, scandal and things.
Sure.
Who did not go to prison whereas back in the early 90s, when we had the savings and loan situation, we had many, many bankers and many, many, you know, leaders of companies go to prison for that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the things you focus on for fear reflect societal values and things that you're trying to promote. So we've tended to stress much more, individual responsibility for criminal acts, but mainly street crime and especially violent crime. And in fact, there's more violent crime in the U.S. than some other countries, there's relatively little violent crime compared to street crime, but that's what we focus on. So when people think about crime, they think about violent crime. And that's where, you know, over the years we've had these unfortunate, disastrous prison policies, three strikes and you're out, mandatory sentencing, and so on. Okay, now that's all part of the context, Sarah, for what we're talking about right now. Because fear is cumulative. People become accustomed to being surrounded by fear. And so what we've created in the United States is what I've called in a lot of my work a discourse of fear that we just take for granted. It's like our background noise all the time. And what that means simply is that we have this sense that crime and threat and danger are pervasive. They're all around us. They can happen anytime. And it's almost as though we're just victims waiting to happen. And this has been going on for decades. And in spite of the fact that the United States, with exceptions in some parts of the country, is really very, very safe and, you know, very, very predictable. Now, this takes us right up to our current situation over the last decade or so, involving not only drugs, but also terrorism. And today, terrorism and immigration, refugees, these are the major sources of fear that politicians are promoting constantly in order to generate public support, in order to get votes, as it were. This last election was the epitome of the height of the politics of fear, and people were played with emotionally. They were manipulated. Numerous distorted and usually untrue statements were being thrown out, and it didn't matter because they were simply trying to get people's votes, attention, and compliance. So that's sort of where we are today, because this really gets people's attention. It leads them to want to take action then against what? Against the sources of this fear. And the sources, of course, are also defined by the propagandist of fear. And so in our case today, the sources of the anxiety in our country, if not actual physical fear about our bodies and the light and the safety of our family members, are terrorists, and especially immigrants who are likely to be terrorists. So the solution then, of course, as it often has been in our country, is to blame the poor, to blame the immigrants, to blame the relatively powerless people for our problems. So we want to crack down immigration. We want to stop terrorism, even though terrorism is not a threat to the physical lives of the vast majority of Americans. You're more likely to get hurt or killed by furniture falling on you in your own home, if not falling out of bed, than you are by a terrorist in our country. And politicians and the people that know, that put this stuff out, they of course know all this, but they're also counting on the you know, the lack of focus and attention on the part of a lot of their audience, in this case potential voters, as well as accounting on mobilizing prejudices and often bigotry that sort of lays below the surface for a lot of their constituents that they can tap into and say, yes, in fact, those immigrants from south of the border, they're not only here, you know, with undocumented, but they're also Mexicans. They look different than we are. They speak Spanish. And in fact, they're likely to be terrorists, gang members, and rapists. And I can go along with that. So this becomes very effective. That's the kind of big picture where we are now.
Well, and you saw it on both sides, because you saw the you know, Republicans, whether they are racist or not, are blamed and told that they're racist and bigots. You know, they're bigots. Like, every campaign uses that against them. And then the other side was using fear of immigrants. And yeah, there are examples of bigots and immigrants that are dangerous, but the vast majority is not the case. Or, you know, it really was used. Well, I had some of the best people in their fields on my show, and I had one of the top neuroscientists in the world, and we talked about the power of propaganda. And he said, and I was worried because we're getting to the point where you can feed messages directly into people's brains. And I'm like, gosh, you know, with propaganda, what are we going to do then, where you could just feed it right to the brain? He goes, we're already there. He goes, in fact, he goes, I think they're so good at cognitive messaging, they're better than we can do with feeding messages to the brain, because they already know how to tap into fear and all these things.
Sure.
And he says, they've already bypassed, you know, these messages are already bypassed, just directly putting messages into your brain.
Well, yeah, I mean, the key thing that we've known from advertising for a long time is that the most effective messages are those that resonate with people. It's what one really good advertiser called you want to tap a responsive chord, you know. So you want to put imaging out there that people just sort of react to, and they sort of complete the message themselves, because they've heard it before, and it's, you know, they are already familiar with it, And for the most part, they agree with it. So it resonates with them. And those are very powerful messages. And this is something especially involving foreign policy that, you know, I mean, all sorts of administrations have used this about fear of the other. Much of our whole military in the United States, the support for it and so on is based on this tremendous fear. And it goes beyond sort of protecting borders and protecting our national interests. It's this constant, hammering away that we're under threat, that you're facing, imminent attack. And the really neat thing about terrorism for people who operate this way is that with terrorism, you don't even need a defined national enemy. You know, it can be anybody, and they can come up anywhere. And so they're out there among us. So we've developed these massive surveillance, programs. And this is really a takeoff, Sarah, from, how we developed things to try to deal with drug use that came out of our drug wars that gave us a lot of our prison population. The notion that a lot of people are using illegal drugs, and so this is a threat to not only them, but it's a threat to all of us because they're breaking the law, and that, it might impede their ability to, let's say, pilot an aircraft or a locomotive or something, or even to work in our hardware store. So to deal with that and to really enforce the law, we push the idea that we can actually not only surveil them buying drugs, but we can surveil their bodies. So we can test them for drugs. And so, we can have them pee in a bottle. We can check hair samples and so on in order to make sure that they're not doing anything wrong. And that's how fear starts feeding very nicely into these ideas about social control and regulation, and this contributes to businesses. It encourages even more efforts and campaigns to try to regulate people, and it often gets a lot of support because this, after all, is keeping us all safe and protecting us from the enemy.
Well, the U.S. passed a recent law, I believe it was 2012, allowing the government to legally do propaganda. Why do you think they actually passed a law saying government can do this?
Well, I don't, the law I'm not familiar with, really, but I think the idea here is that, propaganda is not necessarily, in every case, a bad thing, for example, when we were trying to get people to stop smoking, and a campaign that's been largely successful, it was decided that, putting out targeted messages to try to discourage smoking and to talk about the medical consequences and so on, the health consequences of smoking, that this was desirable from the standpoint of public health. And so, many people, and certainly I would support that. Say, okay,
exactly, yeah.
This makes sense, right? The same way, in a more extreme example, would be, messages you might put out to children to try to strongly discourage them, if not almost frighten them, from playing in the streets. To keep them from running across freeways.
That might be a reason to have propaganda of fear.
Right. Well, right. And so, we go along with messages. So it's not so much that every message of fear is bad. It's that, what's the perspective? What's the context? How do we pick and choose? And ultimately, unfortunately, a lot of this comes down to the individual citizen who's got to be able to you know, sort through these increasingly sophisticated efforts, basically to try to, you know, manipulate you. And as the media have changed so much, this becomes much more difficult because with the rise of social media, as everyone knows, as the media have become more instantaneous, personal, and visual now, we no longer really even need the sort of, you know, mass media to put out a lot of information that might serve to frighten us or something. But now there's all these individual choices out there. You know, they're all over the web. There's numerous blogs and so forth that put out all kinds of information that is, you know, clearly bogus by any standard, but yet many people buy it, they accept it, because it encourages their own view of reality, which is nurtured, and they can share with their friends on their networks, and that's cool because that makes them seem important and knowledgeable too. And so the slightest bit of information now gets passed around, it gets reinforced, it gets amplified, right? And it becomes more authoritative the more times you hear it.
Well,
and this can be very destructive.
Well, the other thing is the more sensational, the greater chance people are actually going to share it and read it and do those things. So people are going after more and more sensational stuff. Like you see it in pop music, except it's with sex, right? The more sexual.
Right.
And they do that to get, and it's now it's like that with politics. The more sensational you can get it, the better.
Yeah, because, you know, things have really deteriorated, but the media have contributed to this in a lot of ways. Right now it's primarily social media, but there's an important history to this. The thing with the social media, it's so fascinating because for over a decade, all kinds of authority has been challenged and ridiculed. So, for example, it's been legitimate to challenge not only the president of the United States, but to make, you know, personally nasty comments about the president. It's become legitimate to challenge science and scientific authority, experts on all kinds of things. And so this becomes encouraged and it becomes more common. And so now we're really to the point, and some politicians bask in this, where, you know, they discount basic facts and say, well, no, those facts don't matter. There's alternative facts. I heard over here, I heard this from this source, that this is what's going on. And if anybody asks, did you check it out? Say, well, no, but I heard it from the source. So this is all taking place there in the context now that basically there are no longer any real facts. Everybody's facts are sort of count the same. Real experts are rare now, that everybody's opinion matters as much. So if somebody gets cold when they go outside on a winter day, they can reject the idea that the planet is undergoing significant warming, because they can say, well, I got cold yesterday, and, you know, it snowed more in my neighborhood, so I don't think we have global warming. So that sort of rejection of science, of authority, of sources of facts, then is encouraged because you can get reinforcement for those views all over the place.
Well, yeah, it's hard for people, an average person, to know, though. I mean, because if you're not an expert in a particular field of science and you're seeing messages from all different it's really difficult, you know. But I think what's happening too is I teach a class on ethics at the business school at the University of Minnesota, and one of the things that we studied just this past week was how the tobacco industry used propaganda to confuse people and to prolong the inevitable legislation that was going to come down, because the scientists were saying, yes, this is causing lung cancer. And so what they did is they created think tanks and they funded alternative studies and things to really confuse the public. And they did it on purpose because their mode, and they found letters and things and strategy meetings showing what they were trying to do, that they were purposely trying to confuse the public and prolong legislation. And they had a pattern for doing it. And the thing is that now we know how to do that pattern. And that pattern is being enacted in so many ways, it's hard to know because that works. The other problem, though, is that science has always been a struggle and a debate, and has always been the edge of science is out, or when you have a new way of thinking about it, has always created, you know, like new scientists are always shunned and stuff, even when they come up with a new paradigm that rocks the scientific base, it creates problems for that scientist and for whoever's trying to promote it. And so I think people have that in their heads. And then so everything is being questioned.
Yeah, I think the sort of ambiguity, the problematic nature of certainty clearly, I think, enters into it. But I think we've, really sort of gone beyond that. I mean, the good example use of tobacco is something that should be a lesson for people, and we need to be reminded of this, that there are very narrow interest groups that want to promote certain views of reality, that want to promote certain ways of what we call framing problems and issues that limit alternatives. And we need to be reminded of that so that when the new ones come up, we can say, in effect, with confidence, look, this is another one of those that's coming up here. You know, just like the tobacco industry fought, tooth and nail to try to keep cigarettes flowing and to maintain their marketing and so on, especially to attract young people. Now we need to be aware of these other efforts now that are going on. I mean, a good example of some of this happening now involves the sort of, the anti-vaccine movements that are out there that with exceptions are based on very little solid information, that certain kinds of vaccines give your children autism and so on. But that these are repeated by neighbors that you like, and you're concerned about your own kids, and everybody has an anecdote, that they've heard about third hand. It becomes very easy to say in this general context of mistrust that we're in, yes, so I'm not going to vaccinate my kid, and the impact this has on, what the epidemiologists refer to as herd vaccination and herd immunity and so on are, really, really quite profound. So a lot of this means that the media have to help us understand these things too. And over the years, this has not been the strong suit for media because fear is great entertainment. Fear gets good ratings. Okay, fear draws attention, and so historically, the mass media have had a real interest in promoting messages of fear and impending danger, and we haven't done very well at trying to explain things. Okay, so it's not surprising that people, aren't aware of some of these things. Although the good news is that as people get a little more education, they develop a little sharper critical thinking skills, And so I think relatively to another period in time, fewer people are sort of snowed and, you know, blown over by a lot of these processes. People are getting a little bit better about thinking through them. And this is why, you know, bad false messages that don't work, that aren't accurate, pretty soon the impact, you know, wears off because more and more people see through them.
Well, there's a really good website called procon.org where it's not a political partisan. What, have you heard of that website?
Yeah.
I think that is pretty good because it shows all the different sides and the data that and the studies that have come out on all sides, and it just provides facts for people, and you can go to it in an objective, and they talk about critical thinking and how people need to
right.
you know, teach critical thinking and how to look at the issues. And of course, for the things that are still out there where we have to learn more, the science will eventually flush out and the good science will win over time. But it's hard to know if you're not educated. So, and if there's lots of scientists that are debating and disagreeing with each other, it's hard to know. So as a critical thinker, you can see all the different sides and what people are saying, and then you can make up your own mind, and eventually the science will work itself out, and then it should be self-evident, you know, evident.
Well, that's what you should hope for. But sometimes it's not only the skill of the message manipulators, but when you have an audience after a while that has become, whether it's out of fear-based anger or other frustrations or in their lives, where they become much more oriented to sort of the negative, you know, the sense that, no, I don't trust them, period, because, you know, whether they have certain prejudices and bias and so on. I don't trust that. And so, you know, if they're telling me something different than what I believe, and that's always difficult to manage, you know, I'm just not going to go for it. So the challenge is that people don't look at things in our day and age as much based on what we might call evidence, and it's not just because they don't understand the evidence, they're just not inclined to even sort of challenge things that run contrary to their opinions of things, you know, that run contrary to the beliefs that they already have. And that's part of the purpose of education, to try to help people learn to crack some of that, but it's not as effective as we would like to think it is. Beliefs and prejudices that people find that they can reinforce in their daily lives are very difficult to crack, especially when we have at the national level, and this is where leadership's so important. Where we have national leaders basically demeaning, you know, science, demeaning sort of tried and true wisdom about things as being, you know, hoaxes and as simply just not being true, that becomes, you know, even more of a challenge.
Well, why do you think the war on terror since 9/11 was used so heavily? And it's been such a focus of the national, you know, our government, this whole war on terror. What's the deal with that?
Well, I think the main thing, Sarah, is that it's effective.
But what you do you think they're trying to promote? Like, what specific... You know, the increased surveillance, the going, you know, going into more war. Why are we doing this to our people?
Well, the main reason, I think, is to enact more social control and to get more compliance with a narrower view about social order, how the world operates, and how we can regulate it more efficiently. When you can exact more compliance from people, this is a very significant sort of political weapon, you know. And there's interest in this. You've got to remember, in the United States, there is a massive arms military industry, okay? And that doesn't mean the military are always trying to promote false things. That's not my point at all. But there's a very strong interest there, okay? So viewing the world in a certain way matters. It has very important consequences. The other thing you've got to keep in mind is that there's many businesses, and not all related to arms and so on, but many businesses that benefit from you know, this sort of terror narrative that we've gotten into. Think of surveillance. I mean, this massive surveillance industry that's taken off. Everything from companies that make cameras to organizations that engage in various kinds of domestic spying and so forth. It's been absolutely incredible, some of the consequences of this. I mean, what we've done with domestic surveillance is just amazing. I mean, a massive study that was done, you know, 7 or 8 years ago about the sort of the spy business. I mean, there's over 1,300 government organizations involving some 2,000 companies that are now employing some, you know, close to 1 million people with top secret security clearances, and they're putting out thousands of reports a year that almost nobody even looks at. I mean, so there's a benefit to this, definitely. And the other thing too is that nobody wants to be stuck with being blamed if something untoward happens. Okay, so when 9/11 happens, you know, there's a lot of blame, finger pointing, and so on, and so nobody wants to be in that position of saying, well, if it happens again, we're going to do, you know, whose head's going to roll on that? So they start taking these draconian measures. People are willing to forego certain civil liberties in order to do things that ostensibly are going to make us safer. Okay, and so there's a number of forces that really get behind it. But especially encouraging is this notion that it's the other people out there, and by that I mean people who are not Americans, people who are different from us, who have different cultures, and those are the people we need to be worried about. And that, of course, carries over into the problems we've had for well over 100 years in this country involving immigrants and new people coming in. You know, we've always treated immigrants pretty shabbily, and this most current level is just kind of an extreme step up.
But isn't that a basic tenet, reaching into people? Because it's kind of the tribal thing that we have, us against them, that whole tribal, you know, they're different, tapping into their different core thing. Sure. That we have as an animal. And they use it against us to propagate whatever message they want and get whatever, you know, to get elected or whatever else they're trying to get accomplished.
Yeah, I think that's it. But these things become far more sophisticated. It's just not saying, you know, it's your family, it's your tribe. It's saying, okay, well, we're going to tell you what that looks like. You know, we're going to tell you. It's laughable for anybody with a high school understanding of history to say that the United States is not all about immigration. You know, it's fascinating. So when you get people holding high office making statements about we've got this dominant American culture that we're losing, you know, and really what they're talking about is race and ethnicity and religion, and so we know, you know, what the true mix really is, and anybody who's not of that is sort of suspect, okay? People who are pushing that are of course playing to these other sentiments, and they're trying to mobilize that, and they're trying to, you know, use that and exploit that for, their own benefit.
Well,
and in the long run, of course, it's a very dangerous thing to do for the world.
Well, we do have an issue with drugs, right? If you're talking about the Mexican border, my husband's from Mexico, right? So my children are actually Mexican citizens. They're dual citizens. But we really have a serious issue with drugs over the border and a lot of violence in that area. But I think we're taking it to an extreme, and then because we're up here in Minnesota, and my daughter's getting comments, you know, towards her. And I think it's important that people understand the context of what is trying to be solved and not use it in such a broad brushstroke that everybody who's Mexican is dangerous. You know, it needs to be put into perspective of what it is that we're trying to get accomplished and what it is that is being done, instead of creating fear just so they can get that agenda passed.
Yeah, I think there's that. But it also involves, you know, I think, and this is where the media could have been more helpful on these things, is going to great pains to figure out, okay, what are the things that people don't understand about these issues? And then if you're a responsible journalism organization, you say, okay, now, so we've got to figure out a way to make sure people understand that situation. And drug is a good example, all right? You know, the problem of drugs in the United States isn't that they're coming over the border from Mexico. That's just a small detail of it. The problem is the drug appetite in the United States, and how this is tied into a number of other very basic issues.
Well, and the CIA has long been involved with drugs, and our government itself has been involved in the drug trade, and there's some issues there. And so we know that it's not just drugs coming up from Mexico, but we do know that the Mexican border is a very dangerous place, and it needs to be dealt with. But I do think understanding that issue is so important, because there's a lot of people that are getting hurt in that process. A lot of people die trying to get across that border. And why is that? And why doesn't Mexico step up their game as well, so that people have more, that there's more incentive to stay in Mexico and flourish in that economy? They have a lot of corruption there. We have corruption too here. Let's not kid ourselves. But the corruption in Mexico really needs to be dealt with. It's not the United States government issue to deal with corruption, but, you know, Mexico needs to step it up a bit. And getting money, having money sent back from people in this country to Mexico really helps their economy. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah. I mean, we're a regional economy. I live in the San Diego area, and the local business people here are just appalled at the propaganda messages about the anti-border stuff that are going on, and they're doing everything that they can to try to offset that.
Because so you get to see it firsthand.
The economies of Mexico and the United States, especially in the Southern California area, are strongly intertwined. But with the border per se, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation out there about the nature of drugs, how dangerous it is, and so forth. You know, terrorism is a virtually non-entity, non-starter when you talk about, you know, terrorists coming across our border in the United States. But these fears have been put out there by a lot of messages about keeping our borders safe and secure. And so bordering becomes another thing that matters a great deal, that's manipulated about our safety and security. And it's all tied into fear. It's this constant sense you get out there about that we're in grave danger. You know, we're subject to attack anytime, and you know, we need drastic measures in order to protect us, to keep us safe. You could say the same thing about people's understanding about our economy. Many people in the U.S. don't have the foggiest idea about how our economy works, including things like how these various trade deals work. You know, again, almost nobody with a modicum of understanding really believes that NAFTA and some of these other deals that we've had going over the years, that these are the main responsible sources for job change, job loss in the country. But that, again, becomes something very easy to blame. Fear and propaganda simplifies. It reduces complexities. It points to a very reachable, observable target of blame that we can focus on and scapegoat, and that will take care of the problem. And that's one reason it's very effective.
Well, Glenn Greenwald had a talk that he gave at TED that's phenomenal, that I recommend everybody to listen to. And he talks about the mass surveillance and how that affects society. It's a really good talk about how mass surveillance actually changes people's behavior, and you're afraid to do things, and we're shutting down innovation and people being sure. able to speak out and say what they think.
Yeah. Yeah. This kind of, you know, sort of auto surveillance. So you start regulating this kind of, you know, chilling effect, you know, that it begins to have, you know, and the anti-immigration sentiment in the United States now has reached you know, some sort of peak levels that we haven't been at to for, you know, you've got to go back for decades to find it. The religious discrimination, fear, when it's pushed right with the propaganda fear, it opens up the doors. It makes it okay now to attack people, if not physically, verbally, you know, to say things in public that maybe you've only thought about privately, especially when you get, again, you know, national leaders openly stating things in very discriminatory, bigoted ways. This opens up the door for things. So we're experiencing this, you know, massive reaction today against Jews, against, you know, Mexican-American heritage people, you know, and of course against races, you know, and because you start pulling inward, you start saying, okay, so all these people have been threats to us. They've been marginalized. They've been on the fringes. They've been hurting us. And now we need to protect ourselves. So it's time we tighten things up around the sort of the true folk, you know, the true real, you know, God-chosen people here. And this starts creating some nasty problems, you know. What the immigration and custom enforcement people are doing in Southern California and some other parts of the country is just devastating, you know, where you
what
now
is going
got
on? What are you seeing?
People. Well, you've got, well, some of the raids they're engaging in, some of the harassments about people that might be undocumented, the fear that people are operating under all the time, you know,
in San
not
Diego,
cooperating
are you,
with police.
Are you,
you
seeing
know?
People who are Americans who look like they might not be being targeted?
Oh, sure. This has been going on for a long time. You know, any you know, large numbers of Mexican American people are being suspect today, and you can see it, and you can talk to many of them, and they will tell you about situations and scenarios. There's many news reports about this. I mean, and people who are here without documentation but have lived in the country for a long time, you know, their lives change, they're afraid to go out of the house, they're afraid to take their kids to school and so on. This sort of fear is not an accident. This is being generated, okay? It's being generated in order to, you know, maintain tighter compliance, to maintain tighter control, to sort of keep people on edge. And that's unfortunate, okay? And this has some nasty political consequences. You know, it doesn't make for a shared society.
What are the nasty political consequences that you see ultimately from the current propaganda of fear that's going on?
Well, one of the things, Sarah, is it starts making people less willing to participate in and engage and support in public life in public spaces. Okay, public spaces become easier to avoid. So things get more privatized.
Yes, I see that already. Yes.
You know, you pull back. In the extreme case, people living more in, you know, in gated communities and those kind of things. But you pull back. Support for public institutions, public schools drops off. You know, there's a push toward more privatized chartered schools and so forth. And there becomes just much more suspicion and less willingness, I'm generalizing now, of course, but to engage in public spheres of things. And this becomes, you know, devastating for a community, you know, for a country. And this has some long-term consequences. One of the main things that was so troubling about this last election was the change in public discourse of civility.
I think that's a big difference because you have a really hard time just having a conversation on some of these basic issues without people getting really angry. You can't just have, I don't know why some things where you just can't learn and try to understand the different situations without everybody getting so angry at each other on everything. And it's kind of gotten out of control on so many issues.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that's related to that is it started becoming okay, you know, a while back that in public life to call people names and to get very personal and to, you know, and this started with some of the big media. It's well documented. Fox News really pushed a lot of this in starting personal sort of nasty attacks on people, you know, challenging their, you know, their basic integrity and so forth. And a lot of this then escalated.
Now everybody does it. Well, everyone does it now.
Yeah. I mean, it became okay to do that. You know, and to not only demean somebody's, you know, intelligence, but their character. I mean, this last campaign where we had the things that were said about women, the things that were said about minority groups, you know, about a physically disabled reporter and so on. These kinds of things, they become okay, you know, because if they're okay to say these things at the top, then, well, I guess it's okay. Well, when you change civil discourse like that, you start making a distinction between what it's okay to think about in private as opposed to say in public. And our public speech and our public manners matter a great deal. And that's, I think, been one of the toughest things, because it's okay to say nasty things about people who are beneath you, outside of you, who aren't you know, truly members of your chosen group. And that can be horrible.
Yeah, it can be. Well, how can people learn more about you and get your books? Because you have, you've written, what's the official name of your book? I know it's about fear-based propaganda.
Well, I have a new edition of a book coming out called Terrorism, the Politics of Fear. And
is it
that'll
be
out
same,
in August.
It'll be the same name. It'll just be edition two? Okay.
Yeah, there was one out in 2006. And then I wrote a book called Creating Fear. And, you know, I wrote another book that was published a year ago called The Media Syndrome. And people can find those on, you know, on Amazon and elsewhere if they're interested.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you didn't, I don't think you had enough time, but you made it. So thank you so much.
Terrific.
And have a great weekend.
Okay, thanks again. Bye now.
Yeah, bye.
So that's all I have today, folks. If you want his contact information, you can go to my website at sarahwestall.com, and I'll have his contact information there, links to his older version of the book. And remember, he's going to have a new book coming out this fall with, you know, incorporating all the latest stuff that's coming out. But I also want to tell you that I have a book, my first book published, called The Wrong Side of History. And it's based on the interview that I did with Senator Richard Black about Syria. He wrote a letter to Assad, and then he took a trip to Syria. The book includes the full letter and includes a full transcript of my interview with him, and then also some additional things that I added in there, pictures, and I also wrote. There's some additional content that I added. But for people who do not like to listen to podcasts, watch videos, a book might be a great alternative for them to get that same information. The information is so important. I might not be a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and I won't be soon, but the information is at least that important. So if you could get that out to people somehow, share it, do whatever you can, tell them that it's available on book form so they can get that information on what's really going on in Syria. Really appreciate. I don't want to be, you know, have our tax money be used to create a mass slaughter. He believes over 4 million people will be slaughtered if Assad falls. Essentially, the whole region will be cleansed. It'll be a mass catastrophe, and we are behind that. And I think people need to know that. I fundamentally believe that if citizens understood what we were doing, it would stop today. This would not continue. But people just are not aware of what's really going on in the world. And it's so important that we become educated and aware so that we stop having these atrocities being committed in our name with our tax money. And I'm not anti, you know, anti-defense. And he's been a military person his whole life. He's not coming at it from a traditional anti-war activism standpoint. He's just trying to share the basic information. Who would want to be behind the Holocaust? And essentially, this will be our version of the Holocaust. And who wants to be behind that? So please share that information. Again, you can go to sarahwestall.com. You can get a copy of the book there. It's only available on ebook on Amazon. However, I will have a paperback version available next week. It's only $4.99, just trying to cover my costs and time, not trying to make a killing, just trying to get the information out there. So again, sarahwestall.com, and I hope everybody has an amazing week and an amazing day.